Morning, everybody. Paul von Gertz here with the news from Knife River. I'm with the Knife River Heritage and Cultural Center. I'm actually their president, and I also write the monthly newsletter, which I'm going to be reading to you today from January. And the response to this newsletter has been really quite good. I ask everybody who reads the newsletter to comment, and they have. And so I'm happy to bring you this newsletter today. Some news, current news from Knife River, certainly, but also a story about a shipwreck that's timely for this time of year. You know, we came off a very bad cold week in February, and I just want you to kind of put your head back into that cold, cold week and visualize the steam coming off Lake Superior. And kind of keep that in mind as I relate this story to you. Again, it's one that I've been familiar with for several years, and I wanted to repeat it. It's about a January sinking of a fish tug that was going from the South Shore to the North Shore. This whole thing led to an incredible tale of survival. So sit back, relax, have that cup of coffee, and just put yourself on Lake Superior this time of year, 20 below zero, going from the South Shore to the North Shore. And here it goes. The sinking of the 95-foot fish tug Thomas Friant in 1924, while en route from the South Shore to the North Shore, has been recorded in several histories of Lake Superior shipwrecks. But what you read here may be one of the more accurate accounts, and is the collective recollections of three people who either got the story first or secondhand from a survivor. The first person that I want to mention here is Marty Peterson, who was told this story by family members. Her grandfather was Einar, also called him Shine, Miller of Bayfield. Shine was co-owner of the Friant and a survivor of the wreck. I am the second person. I heard the story firsthand from the other owner of the boat. His name was Halvor Reitan. He's also from Bayfield. Halvor would later record the sinking in an oral history, which confirmed that he told me many years ago. The third person is Einar Knight, a respected journalist who wrote for the Bayfield County Press from 1950 to 1953 and later wrote a book, Tales of Bayfield Pioneers. At the time she wrote her account of the sinking, both Shine Miller and Halvor Reitan were alive and one can assume provided much of the information for her book. Two others I want to recognize are Lee Bijou and Todd Lindahl. Lee is from Ashland, now a Knife River resident. She connected me with Marty, and so we were able to compare stories about the sinking. Todd Lindahl, many of you know, is our historian for the Heritage Center in Knife River and helped me determine where the crew landed on the North Shore and the train depot to which the shipwrecked crew walked. It was a cold January day with clouds of lake steam emanating from the lake, actually much like those days we remember from February, when I write this story. When, in the early 1970s, Mary and I drove to Bayfield, Wisconsin, one of our happy places, to see what, if any, activity might be taking place. Well, there wasn't, as you can expect. And so we stopped to see our friend Halvor and Sylvia Reitan, who lived upstairs at Halvor's Motorworks shop in downtown Bayfield. Halvor and Sylvia had long been friends of my family and my dad, as my dad was born in Norway, and I believe Halvor was the first generation Norwegian-American. So they had that in common. Plus, Halvor was at one time a boat builder. He also had a boatyard in Bayfield where my family docked our boats since the mid-50s. Well, after a bit of catch-up talk, Halvor commented on the bitterly cold January day and then slowly seemed to fade off to memory of many years earlier. I remember nearly every word he said. Halvor and his good friend Einar, Shine Miller, had come to the conclusion that there could be money made by commercial fishing during the winter months when all other fishermen were in winter layup. Success depended on finding open water, and that would be the North Shore, with its deep and more expended waters and less chance of ice. Well, they pooled their money for 2 months of winter supplies and prepared their boat, the Thomas Friant, which they owned together. The Friant had been an excursion boat on both lakes Michigan and Superior. The partners originally planned on using it for passengers and freight between Duluth and Bayfield, but they changed their minds and converted it to a fish tug. It was built in 1884 of wood, 96 feet long with an 18-foot beam, that would be its width, and 8-foot draft. That's what the water she required to float. The North Shore fishing venture was risky because no insurance company would insure their boat and contents for winter lake fishing. On January 2nd or 3rd, 1924, the temperature began to drop and the protected waters of the Apostle Islands began to freeze in near zero temperatures. They left before ice conditions worsened and headed for Cornucopia, a jump-off point for a course up to Two Harbors, from where they could fish the productive waters between Larsemont and Knife River. Corny is about right across from Two Harbors on the South Shore. When they approached Corny, they were dismayed to see the entry was plugged with pack ice layered by strong northwest winds. We've all seen this. They set an anchor for the evening a few miles offshore, with plans to head for the North Shore in the morning. Hulbert said he got little sleep as he could hear the wind piling up ice around the Friant. The temperature is now 23 degrees below zero. On the morning of January 6, they peered through Lake Steam and discovered they were held firmly in the pack ice, perhaps for the winter. Shine took the opportunity to take a photo of the boat from the ice. But with axes in hand, they eventually broke the Friant free. They stoked Fishtuck's 235-horsepower compound steam engine to full 140 pounds of pressure and headed west towards Port Wing, which is a little west of Corny, where they could see open water, and then, of course, for Two Harbors. A strange thing happened. Rats began to come up from below decks. Did they know something the crew did not? Excuse me. About mid-afternoon, water suddenly began pouring in from the coal bunker and with no way to access the leak. The crew surmised that the pack ice, driven by the northwest wind, had either sprung some hull planks or poked a hole in the boat that night the night before. It soon appeared that Friant's three steam-driven pumps could not keep out the water. They are now midway between the south and north shore. The south shore was rapidly icing in. Their only hope was to make for the open waters on the north shore, 12 miles away. Hulbert Wright and told me Emery Jones from Corny, Cornucopia in short, offered to jump overboard with a tarp and swim under the boat in an attempt to wrap the hull from side to side, more or less in a sling. The pressure of the water, they theorized, would force the tarp tight against the hull and stop the flow of water. But Hulbert and Einar said, no, don't do that. Too dangerous. Now, Eleanor Knight, one of the recorders of this story, makes no mention of Emery's offer, but wrote they were able to tip the boat sufficiently so that John Anderson could be lowered over the side in an attempt to stuff a blanket between leaking planks. He could see that much of the light iron that covered the hull would be sheet metal had been torn off by the ice. He expected the boat to sink. Just what Emery and John may have done or not done remains unclear, but what is clear is that the crew was prepared to save the boat, even if it meant jumping overboard to do so. Soon the rising water entered the firebox. Steam pressure dropped and the pumps failed. The Friant had a single lifeboat on davits capable of holding 19 people. They filled it with what would be needed for a row to the north shore. Hulbert was the last of the nine men to enter it, then watched the lake claim the Friant, bow first and with stern 30 feet in the air. He remembered his pocket watch. He had placed it on a hook above the wheel and had forgotten it. Well, that was gone. Years later, I had a chance to talk to Ken Merriman, who, along with three others, discovered the Friant quite by accident in 2004 using side-scanning sonar. It was resting in 290 feet of water about 12 miles south of Knife River. I told Ken, who kept his boat at the Knife River Marina, about the watch, and because Ken had seen the wreck, said the wreck was upright and in pristine condition, to try to see if the watch could be retrieved somehow by a diver, a robotic arm, and given to a surviving family member of Hulbert's. This is yet to be done. Hulbert's at the till of the lifeboat where the others rowed. Now, Hulbert said, you may think I had the easy job, but the others have the advantage of rowing to keep them warm. Hulbert later commented that while looking at the crew frozen in their seats, that they looked very much like turtles, but with frozen shells on their backs. They rowed until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, until about 11 o'clock that night, in strong northwest wind, rowing into it. But as it became down at dusk, they welcomed a reprieve from the wind. But the northwest wasn't done with them. Night ice began to appear in the calming water. It was too thin to get out and walk, and too thick to row through. So we used our oars to break it up, said Hulbert. They shot off flares, hoping to attract the attention of the Two Harbors tug, Edna G. But they were mistaken by folks as fireworks from diehard New Year's revelers on the South Shore. Besides, in January, no boats would be expected to be on the lake. Near midnight, they could see a light from shore. They headed for it, but when they reached shore, icy cliffs confronted them. They scaled them by cutting footholds in the ice, then followed the light to a fisherman's shack where two fishermen were playing cards. They had landed about 5 miles west of Two Harbors, probably in the Larsemont area. The following morning, after resting and fueling their tired bodies at the fisherman's cabin or shack, they walked another mile to a depot to catch a ride to Two Harbors. Now here, Todd Lindahl, our historian, has surmised that using the logistical information provided by the fishermen, that the depot was where they were, was the Flagstop Depot at Larsmont. It was unmanned, but heated, and would-be riders used a flag or lantern to stop an approaching train. As they sat exhausted, a man came in, sat by the stove, and looked at the dejected survivors. Without a greeting, he suddenly launched into a forceful exhortation, which ended with, "That will teach you a lesson. Lead a better life." However, remembered for emphasis, the man jumped up and down as he preached. He then left. They had no idea what denomination or sect he belonged to, but it was evident he believed in berating the afflicted rather than confronting them. A train approached, and they flagged it down. Upon hearing their plight, the train conductor gave the men free passage to Two Harbors. A restaurant owner there gave them a free meal, acknowledging he had once been shipwrecked. The next day, the crew caught a train to Duluth, and from there they hitchhiked back to Bayfield with little but the clothes on their backs. The crew from Cornucopia then walked the 19 snow-covered miles from Bayfield back to Corny. In 1924, cars were placed on blocks for the winter. Now, a sleigh did come by that could hold two of the four crew members, but the four turned them down. They would stay together. They would not send two of the crew on the sleigh and two back, so they all stayed together. Now, Halvor told me he never recovered from the financial loss of the boat and gear, none of which was insured. In 1924 dollars, the boat was valued at $10,000 and equipment $6,000. That's still a lot of money today. Well, Shine Miller's comment to the news media was, "If every man on the crew had not been a real boatman, we would not have escaped so fortunately." Said Eleanor Knight, "They were all boatmen, trained in the ways of Lake Superior, toughened in the hardships it could inflict upon them, and they made it." November 9, 2019, the Thomas Friant was listed on the National Register of Historic Places. What an amazing story, true, from different sources, and happy to share it to you today as part of the news from Knife River. Speaking of news, we had some news made after the first of the year, good news. Many of you know Randy Ellistead. He owns the Knife River Campground. Well, he bought the Coolidge Brothers building. Remember the Coolidge Brothers building and little east of Kendall's there on the same side of the road? Here's what took place. Well, Randy purchased it, the Coolidge Brothers garage and machine shop. It's at actually at 171 Scenic Drive at Knife River. And the transaction was completed in early January. When I learned that Randy said that when I learned that Brian and Tim Coolidge were considering selling the building, I bought it because of its prime location on Scenic 61 and its great potential for a variety of businesses that cater to the increasing number of visitors traveling the North Shore. When people driving by saw the activity taking place and stopped, Randy said, they offered a lot of ideas for the building and even wanted to rent part of it, said Randy. So, for now, Randy is concentrating on emptying out the former machine shop and cleaning and painting it. Once I can stand back and see the open space available, I will come up with how to use it, said Randy. And that's actually happened. Several people have approached Randy and see potential for the building, wanting to rent space, or wondered if he's going to make apartments there or what have you. And if they were going to make apartments, some people have actually showed an interest already. So we'll see. We'll see what Randy comes up with. Little history on it, the Coolidge Brothers. Their garage and machine shop has been a fixture in Knife River since 1923, when A.I., that's his name, A.I., and Mary Coolidge moved to Knife River from Michigan and opened a gas station and garage on Knife River. Well, A.I., being a natural machinist, began machining hard-to-find parts for cars and anything on wheels. He had three sons, Francis, they called Dutch, Lauren, who they called Punk, and Lloyd, they called Irish, would eventually join him, and by consensus of local gearheads, the Coolidges were nothing short of brilliant and without formal educations. Soon they were producing custom machine parts for a variety of local manufacturers and businesses. Besides being skilled machinists, the Coolidges were inventors. A Dutch invented the Coolidge Trollo plate that was sold around the nation for trolling at deep depths. A previous story on this trolling plate was really neat. It kind of hard to explain without a picture, but it would dive down. It was a diving plate and would take a fisherman's lure down to 100 to 150 feet and so. And then when a fish hit it, it would trip and the plane would reverse itself and bring itself and the fish to the surface. Really pretty smart. Any of you that have used Pink Lady on the Big Lake would recognize the design. Now, the Coolidge is, I had the patent on this thing for about 20 years, but then that ran out and others copied it. And, of course, your patent is only good as your ability to defend it. And that was probably what did away with the Coolidge, the Trollo plate. Anyway, Brother Punk built and flew his own ultralight aircraft, mostly from scratch. Now, Dave Coolidge, many of you know him. He was the son of Dutch. He's the founder and past owner and president of Serco Knuckle Boom Loaders here in Two Harbors. At one time, the business employed several and many part-time machinists to make custom machine parts for equipment manufacturers throughout the upper Midwest. Well, while Coolidge Brothers is now part of Knife River history, it is reassuring to know the building continues to be locally owned. Randy is recognized as a respected Knife River historian and has already pledged to display and incorporate Coolidge Brothers memorabilia on both the outside and inside of the building, regardless of what happens to the space. Okay, just got a few minutes left here, so let me kind of quickly go through the other news here as far as the Heritage Center goes. We are, of course, always looking for help, financial help. We've got some ambitious plans for the summer. One that we need to do is build a fence that will parallel the right-of-way to keep folks who visit our center either by car or by train off the right-of-way. My last story I think you'll like. My last month I reported on name-calling in Knife River, and that name-calling referred to streets in Knife River, roads in Knife River that were misnamed, at least from a historical aspect. But I wanted to add some more here. If you are a Knife River resident and you have a P.O. box, well, that makes you a resident, I guess. You can probably consider yourself a Knife Riverite. And if you like, you can also consider yourself a Herring Choker. Hey, what great name for any Knife River sports team, the Knife River Herring Chokers. What if that would be offensive to anybody? Well, when Mary and I moved from Park Point to Duluth in 1972, there were still many old-timers here, and we on occasion would hear the term Herring Choker, usually applied to the old-timers, and usually by people from Two Harbors and even French River. I always thought the term referred to all the herring choked down as Knife River, as a Knife River meal staple, and learning, too, that Knife River was at one time a huge exporter of fresh fish, of fresh herring, as far as Chicago. So Knife River had quite a reputation. In fact, you know, once refrigeration came in, a fish caught in out of Lake Superior in the morning could be packed in ice and in Chicago 24 hours later. Well, I Googled the term herring choker just to see what I could learn about it, and the definition I got was someone who comes from New Brunswick, Canada. The term is derived from the stereotype that people living in the Canadian Maritimes eat only fish, herring in particular. So my first inclination of the origin of the term seemed to be correct. But as a double check, I talked to a longtime Knife River native connected to a commercial fishing family who claimed the term originated from Norwegian fishermen who pulled herring from their nets by pinching their gills and pulling them through the net. Tripping over my tongue here. Sorry, folks. The practice appeared that the fisherman was choking the herring in the process. So if you're into embroidering your shirts or jackets and proud to be identified with Knife River, feel free to stitch the words herring choker on your clothing. There, now you're really cool. Okay, just a couple minutes left here. Some of the news from the Heritage Center board meeting was held in January. It's our annual board meeting. Board members all re-upped. Projects that we want to complete yet this summer is we want to put this fence in, which is part of our contract with the North Shore, with the Regional Rail Authority, who is our landlord. Always looking for help with that. So that's about 330 feet of fencing that we've got to put in. We also want to finish a cement slab that's around the depot. It's an apron that was heaved and cracked and been replaced, and that whole project got delayed because of COVID. And lastly, we do want to complete the freight building adjacent to our depot. The roof needs to be completed. So that's basically it, the news from Knife River. I think I finished it with a few seconds to spare. Keep in mind that we're always here the second Saturday of every month. Yep, second Saturday of every month from 9 o'clock. Repeats on Sunday. So, okay, until the next month, Paul von Gertz here with the Knife River Heritage and Cultural Center. Hope you enjoyed today's news and also stories about some remarkable survivors of a Lake Superior shipwreck. Have a nice day. We'll visit next month.